You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 22nd of February, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And as it's Friday, of course, we do have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, are you there?
I'm here. Just.
Excellent. Excellent. I was a little bit worried then. I was thinking, oh no, we got technical problems. We do seem to have gotten sorted out though. We've got an alternative microphone that you're on. So I do hope everyone can hear you okay. How are you doing anyway?
Well, it's been one of them days. I took another visit to the local gulag to have some more drilling done on my tooth. And I should be ready for a couple of weeks' time. But meanwhile, I'm a bit toothless.
Well, we're very lucky to have you then if you've been having surgery done on your teeth. I mean, that normally prevents people from being able to talk or eat.
Yeah, well, I'm, a bit of tough stuff, I think.
Oh, well done. Well done you for making it. Yeah, well, we've got, we're going to continue on with our look at the church behind the fascists this week, continuing with the book that we've been looking at, Behind the Dictators. And we're going to be looking at Vichy France, and we're going to be looking at the Angelus tonight. And I think we've got some really interesting stuff. I mean, we've just found out some information that we didn't have at first to do with Winston Churchill and France. And we were just saying before we came on air, I mean, you think you've heard it all about Winston Churchill, and you think you know just about it, and then more comes up. I mean, the man was just a total devil. When we get to it, you'll understand what we mean. Well, I think we'll start with a quote about a Catholic newspaper or a periodical that was actually talking about Vichy France. And again, this comes from Behind the Dictators. One insight was furnished by the Catholic International, a new periodical recently published in New York. It identified itself as a magazine of Christian decency for the Christian home and edited under clerical direction. This magazine contained the following amazing comment on the fall of France. Quote, "The earthly disaster has been a heavenly blessing. The days of socialism and Freemasonry are gone forever in France. Isn't it all glorious?" And turning to Italy, it continued, "And in Italy too, the base little atheist schoolmasters have been booted out forever, and monks and nuns now again teach the children of the peninsula." So that's really a glowing recommendation of the National Socialist occupation of France and also fascist Italy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it shouldn't surprise people, to be honest, because obviously with the French Revolution, things changed in France. As it captured the Pope died in captivity. And lo and behold, a mass of dead priests at the end of the revolution, which lasted for about 10 years. So, and obviously after that, obviously the Freemason ethic is to separate church from state and teach no religion whatsoever. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, it shouldn't surprise people because obviously these people would have been over the moon.
It's surprising, isn't it? People today, they will be all anti-Christian and they'll try and link Christianity to communism. But the communists just wiped out Christians, killed priests. And the first thing they did when the National Socialists took over in France was put the church back into its position again. Got the church teaching the children again. I mean, that really shows you the backing that they had for Catholicism. And Vichy France is really interesting. There's a lot I didn't actually know about it that I've just found just from looking at it, about that it wasn't actually a fascist government. And after the war, they didn't find anything to link it with the fascist governments. It had its own way of doing things. And it was a rejection of the French Revolution and all the degeneracy that went along with that. And they had their own unique form of nationalism, basically, that was done away with. It's fascinating stuff, and I've just got really a summary of it here. This bit this first bit comes from Wikipedia. It says, after being appointed premier by President Albert Lebrun, Marshal Pétain's cabinet agreed to end the war and signed an armistice with Germany on the 22nd of June 1940. On the 10th of July, the French Third Republic was dissolved and Pétain established an authoritarian regime when the National Assembly granted him full powers. The Vichy government reversed many liberal policies and began tight supervision of the economy, calling for national regeneration, with central planning a key feature. Labour unions came under tight government control, conservative Catholics became prominent, and clerical input in schools resumed. Paris lost its avant-garde status in European art and culture. I guess the degenerate status that means.
Wow.
Yeah. And the media became tightly controlled and was used to expose Jewish and Freemasonic plots. And after June 1941, it became anti-Bolshevik. And that's pretty good, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And from that, we got the French Charmaine SS who defended the bunker in Berlin. After not having surrendered on May the 1st. And so the only people really who were causing any problems were this French resistance. And I think most of them were Jews.
Well, no, they were terrorists, weren't they? I mean, there is no way there should have been any resistance. And it says here they had an armistice, basically. If you look up armistice, this is from Encyclopedia Britannica, armistice, an agreement for the cessation of active hostilities between two or more belligerents. Generally, the terms, scope, and duration of an armistice are determined by the contracting belligerents. An armistice agreement may involve a partial or temporary cessation of hostilities, called a local armistice or truce, established for a variety of specific purposes, such as collecting the dead, or it may involve a general armistice, which is a total cessation of all hostilities, such as the French Armistice Agreement of 1940. So all hostilities should have ceased. So this French resistance that gets lauded today were just a bunch of terrorists. They were breaking international law, and they're made out to be heroes.
That's right. I mean, to be honest, the footage when I found in the first documentary, when the war finished, was pretty disgusting. What they did to women and such, you know, and probably a lot worse.
Well, if you think they were basically communists before the National Socialists went there, I mean, that's pretty much what it's saying. They had liberal policies, basically.
Yeah.
And obviously, where it says conservative Catholics became prominent and clerical input in schools resumed, they'd obviously cut all Christian content out from the schools.
Right.
It must have been very close to communism that they actually had in France at the time. And also because there was a lot of support for the National Socialists. I mean, let's just continue with what it says in Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. It says the occupation was to be a provisional state of affairs pending the conclusion of the war. So it was just supposed to be temporary. It wasn't, you know, the invasion of France, wants to take over the world. It was just pending the conclusion of the war, which at the time, 1940, appeared imminent. The occupation also presented certain advantages, such as keeping the French Navy and French colonial empire under French control and avoiding full occupation of the country by Germany, thus maintaining a degree of French independence and neutrality. Despite heavy pressure, the French government at Vichy never joined the Axis alliance. Now, as we were reading that, you pulled me up on that and said, well, this sounds a bit strange that they were allowed to keep the French Navy, because didn't Winston Churchill destroy the Navy?
Correct.
So what happened there, Dennis?
Well, apparently after Dunkirk and the following procedures of the treaty, what they signed with Germany, the fear was of Churchill was that Germany would seize that navy and use it against Britain. But they weren't allowed to do anything because at the time the French had agreed with Germany that, you know, they would keep the fleet. But Churchill still wasn't happy. And so they arranged for either France to sell the fleet to America, surprise, surprise, Roosevelt's sniffing around, or sell it to Britain. Or destroy it. And so they agreed that if there was any inclination that the Germans would seize it, which there never was, they would sail to the USA. But unfortunately, he didn't really follow through with that, Churchill. Instead, he decided to sink the whole lot.
Yeah, you know, this is just it, wasn't it? He was trying to say to them, look, either go to America or whatever. And he was also trying to bribe the leader of the fleet. This reminded me of, you know, when the devil tempts Christ and says, "Well, I'll give you the king. You can be kings of all these different nations."
Churchill was saying, yours.
"Yeah, well, Churchill's doing that to the leader, the head of the French fleet. He's saying, I could make you the leader of this country. I'll make you the leader of that country. I'll make you into the great hero, the liberator of France." And the leader of the fleet is saying, but that goes against the law. That goes against our treaty. We've got a treaty of peace. And he said, and look, I've got this from Hitler. It says that if the Germans try to take the boats at all, we are to head straight to America. And that order has been given to all the heads of the ships. And that wasn't good enough for Churchill. And the war cabinet back in Britain said, no, you can't scuttle those ships. France is an ally. We don't want to be starting a war with France. And then he did it anyway. And you said that he destroyed the whole fleet. But according to the report that we saw, that I think it was 100 or so Frenchmen were killed. Three ships were destroyed. And a destroyer was also destroyed. And the French were absolutely furious about this. And apparently the British were doing like a dance of joy. Imagine stabbing your ally in the back.
Is a bit wet out. Something over 1,000 from what I can gather.
Just imagine that. You know, he's just stabbed his ally in the back there.
Yeah. I'm just trying to find the exact figure. I'm pretty sure it's around about 1,200 to 1,700.
Yeah, I might have been out there thinking it was 100. I'm not too good with numbers.
Yeah, I think
maybe
well
10
there,
times
yeah.
that. Probably 10 times that. But yeah,
I expect Churchill even worse than what you thought.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And you imagine how angry the French would have been at that. You know, Britain's just destroyed our fleet, destroyed our navy. They're supposed to be our allies.
Obviously. Back in Britain, like, they seemed to celebrate it.
Yeah, they thought it was great.
You know, First time I've ever known allies get massacred.
Well, this was a war unlike any other war, wasn't it, basically?
Yeah, well, fair enough. I think the message was from Churchill and the rest over here that this war continues and, you know, as long as it lasts, which, you know, obviously they never offered one peace treaty in all the time and turned down all the peace treaties that Germany offered. So it's obviously that, you know, they wanted this war.
He was determined to just destroy half of Europe and destroy the Germans and destroy Hitler. It was like a personal vendetta, I think, from Churchill. Hitler was doing all he could to try and avoid this war and not taking over these countries. I mean, as it says here, that this French government, they have pretty much full autonomy, just as long as they weren't going to attack Germany. That was all there was to it. He didn't want to destroy any French troops. And continuing with what it says from Wiki, French police were ordered to round up Jews and other undesirables, such as communists and political refugees. And of course they would have been asked to do that because they were the enemy. It was the Jews that first declared war on Germany, and obviously the communists and these political refugees, they're enemies in the war. So of course the French police were ordered to round them up. Much of the French public initially supported the government, despite its undemocratic nature and its difficult position vis-a-vis the Germans, often seeing it as necessary to maintain a degree of French autonomy and territorial integrity. Remember, this is all totally legal. There's been an armistice. And then it just sort of glosses over all the terrorist attacks from the French resistance. And it says, following the Allied invasion of France in June 1944, And the liberation of France, it calls it the liberation of France, but there's an armistice.
Yeah.
That's like somebody going in and bombing Ireland or Northern Ireland and calling it liberating Ireland or liberating Northern Ireland, because they're under an armistice at the moment. It means that both these countries want peace. I don't think Northern Ireland would be very happy about somebody going in there, bombing the place and saying they were liberating it. The French Provisional Government of the French Republic was then installed by the Allies as France's government, led by de Gaulle. So it's not as if the people actually chose this. This was just forced upon them. The same as the government that was then forced upon Germany after the war. So France then has this government forced upon them, and then under a national unanimity cabinet uniting the many factions of the French resistance, so the terrorists, the GPRF re-established a provisional French Republic, thus apparently restoring continuity with the Third Republic. Most of the legal French government's leaders at Vichy fled or were subject to show trials by the GPRF, and a number were quickly executed for treason in a series of purges. And it was the French resistance who were carrying out the treason. Thousands of collaborators were summarily executed by local communists and the resistance in so-called savage purges.
This is why I said about the Catholic Church getting the Axis soldiers out best they could, and you know, because it would have been, every one of them would have been slaughtered.
Now these guys are made out to be the heroes today, and they were the traitors. You know, France didn't want this. France had signed an armistice.
Well, but France were living in a state of peace, so when the Americans come, it kind of like they weren't impressed.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine it, can't you? I mean, if you look at the pictures, you can see the before and after pictures. France under German occupation, life is going on as normal. There's no police there with guns. There's no worries about being mugged on the streets or immigrants setting fire to things. And suddenly the place is being shot up by planes and soldiers are in there raping. It wasn't liberating the country. It was an invasion. And a new government made up of terrorists and communists forced on the people.
Exactly.
It's no wonder
De Gaulle,
not happy.
Richard, was
it? Yeah. I'd like to probably do some more research into this, actually, because it does look as if there's a very interesting history. The Wikipedia page is a huge page on this. There was a lot of, I mean, it says that the art, and it lost its place as the avant-garde of the art world, but looking at what it says on Wikipedia, it looks like France was actually very, very creative in this time that they had this separate government. Because obviously it was a nationalist government, so they were promoting the sort of things that communists don't want promoted, like individual expertise and excellence. And I'd like to find out if there are any English translations of works that were produced by the French nationalists at the time.
Well, I think Pétain was left in charge, and then after the war he was sentenced to death. But he didn't actually follow that through. He said to give him a life sentence. I think he died in prison about 90, something like that.
And it's just so shocking that the truth about the war is just a complete opposite of everything that we've been taught. All of it, you know, France, Italy, Austria, all these countries. The real history is the opposite of everything that's in the history books. Well, the next bit that we've got, moving back to behind the dictators, we've got a little bit about the bishops in Austria. 5 days after the Anschluss came the political denouement, when the Austrians were confronted in the morning with big posters everywhere. It was an address to the Catholic people of Austria, signed by all the archbishops and bishops of the country, headed by the name of Cardinal Innitzer, Archbishop of Vienna. The undersigned prelates declared therein that they had deeply considered the situation and had decided that Adolf Hitler had proved to be the protector of German rights and culture. They expressed their conviction that his leadership would guarantee material and moral happiness to the German people in the future, and they therefore entreated the faithful people to trustfully follow the Führer. So they obviously supported National Socialism. Catholic bishops were the first to step forward. And do that. So they'd obviously been instructed to.
Well, the guy who wrote the Behind the Dictators, he actually has it from a different point of view. He says that for days before the Anschluss, they had bombers flying over over Austria. People were terrified in the houses and such like, which when you see, you know, the 99.7% vote to join the Reich, and you can understand why it was so high, because let's face it, one of Austria's sons is coming home to rejoin Austria with Germany, which has always been a historical factor. And so obviously there's great excitement. When Hitler arrived, we've seen the mass crowds, showed that in the Great Story Never Told. And it was just, I mean, how they could call that an invasion, I'll never know. Certainly weren't no shots fired.
According to Wikipedia, again, they distort things. And they try to say that Austria really didn't want this. And Hitler was forcing the government to do this, and the government was going to hold a plebiscite. Hitler said that he didn't trust the government to do this. And Wikipedia makes out that this was all forced on Austria, basically. But it can't have been.
It was a democratic result, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, I've got the results from that later on in this quote, but just from the film that you showed of it, I mean, there are thousands of people, they're hanging out of their houses, they're all waving, they're all cheering. You think this is a famous son of Austria that has done fantastic things in Germany and has become the leader of Europe and is now uniting Germany with Austria, which was a dream that both nations had for centuries. And he was finally doing it.
Apart from the historical factor, the close ties they've always had, they looked at Germany, and obviously Germany now is an economic powerhouse. They're under usually the usual Rothschild banking system. And so can you blame them for being enthusiastic? Because they could see how Germany was and now is, and they're thinking, let's get on board because we've had enough of this system which the bankers have put us under.
I guess the Austria became absorbed into the Reich, so they had exactly the same banking system as Germany. Not like in France where they had the option to do whatever they wanted to do. It's like Austria then became a part of Germany. So they had all the same benefits that the German people had.
And of course, this is where they took it up with the Rothschilds. They arrested the Rothschild, Baron Rothschild, I can't remember his first name. Instead of, like many people said, why didn't we kill him? Well, he started a war. He put him up for ransom, took all his personal wealth and other Rothschilds who quickly moved out of Austria. And so this, I think it was something like 660 million, it's still a world record today for a sole kidnapper, you know, a ransom fee. So he got a lot of money back to compensate for what he thought that the banks had ripped off the Austrians throughout that time. You know, fair enough. That's what, I thought that was the right decision.
Yeah, it's probably better than, trying him and executing him, actually making something out of it for
which is what Austrian people.
Yeah, some good to get some kind of compensation for them.
Yeah.
This is from Wikipedia on the Anschluss. On the morning of 12th of March, the 8th Army of the German Wehrmacht crossed the border into Austria. The troops were greeted by cheering Austrians with Nazi salutes, Nazi flags, and flowers. For the Wehrmacht, the invasion was the first test of its machinery. How can that be the first test of an invasion when they're being greeted by people with salutes, flags, and flowers? It's not an invasion, is it?
War of flowers in the air.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a test of the Wehrmacht's machinery. I mean, a test of that would have been the Blitzkrieg into Poland. Not, sort of strolling across the bridge into Austria, being greeted with flowers. It says, although the invading forces were badly organized and coordination among the units was poor, it mattered little because the Austrian government had ordered the Austrian Bundeswehr not to resist. And, they must have ordered them not to resist because they knew that the people wanted this. And it was only the bankers that didn't want this and the rest of Europe. It must have been fear of the people that prevented him from saying, look, fight them. Because he knew they wouldn't have done it.
Well, I was reading the other day, actually, I think it was last October, the Austrian government knocked down the place where Hitler was born. And obviously, you know, they took away the headstone to his parents. So this is a very, you know, it's a government which doesn't want any remembrance at all of Nazi Germany.
You know, by doing things like that, it just makes people all the more interested in it to find out what went on. You know, you need to look at both sides of the story, and what they've done is they've said, oh, no, you're not allowed to hear that. We don't want you even looking at what the other side of the story is. And that just shows you that, you know, the guys that won were on the wrong side. The good guys are on the side they don't want you to hear about.
If anybody goes on to IMBD and can read the reviews of The Greatest Story Never Told, obviously it's got a lot of tens. It outweighs the 1 out of 10s by a huge margin. Well, the people who give it 1 out of 10, it's just exactly what you're saying. They always say in it, don't watch this crap, because they know what happens when people watch it and get the other side of the story. In every single comment, more or less, where it gives 1 out of 10, don't watch this, it's Nazi propaganda or whatever. So it's just, if anybody takes the support with it, you'll see for yourself.
Yeah, they won't try to refute it. They'll just come out with insults as old Nazis, Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, they will say it's lies, but they never list them.
This is why they don't want you to look into it, because you see that they were welcomed with flowers. This wasn't an invasion.
Right.
Not at all. That afternoon, Hitler, riding in a car, crossed the border at his birthplace, Braunau out in, with a 4,000-man bodyguard. Now, just look at that sentence. Now, we've seen the pictures of this. This is an open-top car with him stood up. He hasn't got 400-man bodyguard, 4,000-man bodyguard. How are they going to protect someone who is stood up in an open-top car?
Fearless.
You know, that's somebody who's loved by his people. It's like Gaddafi, when he used to ride around Libya in his open-top car, and everyone used to run out and cheer, basically. He didn't need a bodyguard. And Hitler didn't need a bodyguard here. In the evening, he arrived at Linz and was given an enthusiastic welcome. The enthusiasm displayed towards Hitler and the Germans surprised both Nazis and non-Nazis, as most people had believed that a majority of Austrians opposed the Anschluss. Well, that must have been thanks to the Austrian propaganda, because the newspapers were trying to pretend that there wasn't any will to join Germany, and that this was all German thinking and German propaganda. So this proves that wasn't true. Hitler's journey through Austria became a triumphal tour that climaxed in Vienna on 15th of March 1938, when around 200,000 cheering German Austrians gathered around the Square of Heroes to hear Hitler say that the oldest eastern province of the German people shall be, from this point on, the newest bastion of the German Reich. That's 250,000 people.
Yeah.
It's probably more than that.
Yeah, you have to remember that the only reason that Austria and Germany were apart was the Versailles Treaty. So this was just another chunk which, you know, we managed to get rid of.
Well, didn't Austria had a separate... thing, didn't they? Austria and Hungary, they had a separate, although they were German peoples, they did have a separate Reich, didn't they? A separate administration.
Yeah, it was Austro-Hungary, as it was called, but they were banned from ever joining with the Reich, which has always been a dream of the nationalists of both Germany and Austria, because they considered themselves the same.
Yeah, the same ethnicity. Hitler later commented, "Certain foreign newspapers have said that we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say, even in death, they cannot stop lying. I have, in the course of my political struggle, won much love from my people. But when I crossed the former frontier into Austria, there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators." Now, compare that, Hitler going into Austria, welcomed with flowers, with D-Day, with the D-Day liberation. Yeah. And it really, you know, it's there in black and white, isn't it? I mean, he's using the same language.
I found out some information a couple of weeks back, actually, that they had a kind of a trial run of D-Day down, I think it was in Cornwall. And believe it or not, two U-boats were passing. And so all these ships dropping off soldiers and whatever, and they just attacked. And they lost a lot of men. People are rarely told about things like this. And it is, I'll try and find out more details for you next week if I can, but it really was a heavy loss. And so they didn't tell the nation about it. Just happened to be passing by two U-boats.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that before. So there was a lot of loss on the British. So the U-boats attacked the British, or the British attacked the U-boats?
Yeah, a full-scale practice. I think, I'd be guessing really, but, you know, in the thousands died. I'm pretty sure of that. I'll double check.
I mean, the loss of life was just massive. And we don't know the numbers, do we? I mean, everybody's got to know the 6 million Jews that died, you know, right down to the last Jew was counted, and there were 6 million. Nobody knows how many Europeans died. Nobody knows.
I can't believe the number they give for D-Day, because if you've got, you know, a dozen machine guns, you know, aimed at a mass of bodies coming onto a beach, there's going to be more casualties than what they reckon.
Shocking. And you know, we just put up these monuments to Jews. Where are the monuments to the British people?
Well, certainly the Soviets have them, not in Germany.
Yeah, where's our museums in every town? Like, they want to put Holocaust museums everywhere and brainwash all the kids with Holocaust. Why aren't they taught about the British did, and how many Germans died? I mean, that was the worst one, was the number of Germans that died.
Well, after the war.
Yeah, they're not allowed to have any monuments to the Germans that died over in Germany. You know, not allowed to mourn their dead or what happened to them, or all the expulsions afterwards.
Another little piece of information, like, I was answering a comment on YouTube. I think somebody, that was it, Bruce Springsteen, born in the USA, and a list of people in comments underneath, well, I was born in USA, I was born in England, and then somebody said, I was born in Germany. And I just happened to put, well, that's all right, because it's a colony of US anyway. And this girl come back and put one of them little figures up, which were equivalent to rolling on the floor laughing. She had no idea that Germany was a colony of the US.
Not just Germany. I mean, I would say France is as well.
Well, yeah.
If the Allies steamed in there and just forced a new government on them, then they've been occupied since then as well, haven't they?
Well, he said the borders of the US stop at the Rhine, if you remember last week. And looking at the map, it certainly does.
Yeah, but these, you know, this liberation, any of these countries that were liberated, the rightful government was removed, and a puppet government was installed. So all the countries that were supposedly liberated during that war are actually under occupation.
And still are.
Finally, from this quote here, the Anschluss was given immediate effect by legislative act on the 13th of March, subject to ratification by plebiscite. Austria became the province of Ostmark, and Seyss-Inquart was appointed governor. The plebiscite was held on the 10th of April and officially recorded a support of 99.7% of the voters. 99.7%. None of them wanted to go back to the government that they had before.
Now, can I say that is the figure given in the GC exams? That is the correct answer when asked that question. That's where I got the source from. I did it in the first documentary. So they even admit it.
Well, they say it was properly counted as well. They say it was all properly counted. And then Wikipedia tries to say, oh, yes, but they had Germans that were in voting booths. they had Germans that were collecting the boxes. Well, you know, you've got to have somebody that's collecting these boxes full of the votes.
Exactly.
You've got to have someone that's manning these, you know, these voting booths. You can't just have nobody in there. You've got to have somebody in there. But that shows you that after a month, they had the Germans there for a month. And after having the Germans there for a month, 99.7% of them said, we don't want to go back to the government we had before. We want to stick with the Germans. So it's true to say they were liberated. And if you look at after the war, Britain didn't vote for Winston Churchill. We didn't vote for Churchill. This government that was forced onto the French. I mean, I don't know how many people voted for them. they were probably just not given an alternative. That's what they've done, isn't it? In Germany, they said, yeah. You can't have an alternative to this. And they've even got a special department, a special police department to investigate political parties so that if any of them come anywhere close to National Socialism, they will be banned outright. They're investigating.
Yeah, well, it's the same in UK as well.
Yeah, they're banning the investigating the AFD at the moment, who are even in Parliament. They've got a special political police over there, specifically just to prevent there ever being a proper nationalist government. And they've probably done the same in France.
I can believe it.
You know, you talk about Zionist occupied government, then here's all the proof of it. All these governments are now occupied, and the puppets were just forced upon the people. We're told, oh, democracy this, we must export democracy everywhere. And yet there was no democracy for the French, no democracy for the Germans, no democracy for the Austrians after the war. They all just had a new government forced upon them and told you, this is it. You've got no choice.
Yeah. And over in the Middle East as well, it continues.
Yeah, and that's what they're doing out there in the Middle East now. Now let's move away from Austria. We've got the Lateran Accord, which was between Italy and the Vatican, and this comes from Lehman's Behind the Dictators. In 1929, the Lateran Accord between the Pope and the fascist government was published. Besides receiving from Mussolini 750 million lira in cash, and 1 billion lira in fascist government stock, the Vatican got a tiny but substantial sovereignty carved out from Italy's heart, a treaty and a concordat, making Catholicism the sole church of the kingdom and giving the clergy full control over the people's education. The union between the Vatican and fascism was publicly sealed. The Vatican could now, after many years, enjoy again the attributes and privileges of diplomatic sovereignty, which are of inestimable value in the game of international politics, though meaningless to religion and even incompatible with it, it says here. And is it since then that the Vatican has had this role as being a sovereign state? Did it have that before then? Because I'd be surprised if that was kept after the war, if it was a deal that the Vatican did.
I think it still is, yeah. I think it's just like the City of London and Washington is the same, where they're a state within a country, if you know what I mean. They're not under the country's government and their rules. But obviously, with the Rothschilds taking over the Vatican again, the Freemasons, it's not a problem for them anyway, is it? Because they just replaced the Pope.
No, I'd be surprised if that treaty was honoured. I mean, obviously, the Vatican is a separate sovereign state, but I'm just wondering if that originated here with this deal, this Lateran Accord.
Well, I'd guess that they made their own, changed it and made their own treaty, I would think. I don't think they left it under the Mussolini one.
And again, you can see the link between the church and fascism. The clergy got full control over the education of the children.
That's right.
Total opposite of what we've got now with the separation of church and state, and you can't have prayers in the school. So you can see
in Europe,
you can see why the Vatican would be supporting fascism. You really can, because it was.
Well, you can see Christian. Now this argument about paganism and everything else. You can see the foundation now of what was happening in Europe and what nobody knew outside of Europe. You've got Belgium, you've got France, you've got Italy, and France did have a treaty with Germany, obviously, but, you know, the Concordat, they all had Concordats, you know, all these Catholic countries, and they all had Catholic leaders, and not Protestant maybe, but it was a religious foundation to it all, and that's, you know, it just defeats any reason why they should be pagan. Should, maybe, you know, one or two maybe, you know, in National Socialism, but the overall majority was this, it is the most Catholic government Germany ever had.
All these deals were done straight away, weren't they, as well, between the church?
Bang on straight away, yeah, because we were not done, really.
And what this author is saying is that the connections were there beforehand, and that the church had been bankrolling these nationalist organizations. Correct. So that once they came to power, it was straight in there doing a deal,
Need the bankers, did they? You know, this myth of the bankers funding him. Why would they need bankers when they got the Vatican?
Yeah.
And this Tyson, he's a billionaire. He's another one.
Yeah, we'll come to him in a minute. I've got a message from Z Cuxlayer in the chat room. He says in 1929, the Vatican became a state. So I'm not sure what was happening there in 1929. Where was? Yeah, that was it. That was the Lateran Accord between Italy and the Vatican.
With Mussolini, yeah.
So it was 1929. So they actually honoured that deal with Mussolini, but what they did was then take over the church.
Yeah.
After the war. So, as you say, it didn't really matter. Well, let's move on to this the Concordat with Germany then. And that was the big one. And first off, we've got a little bit from Article 16. Article 16 of the Concordat between Hitler and the Vatican gives the wording of the oath that all German bishops are obliged to take before the Reichsstatthalter. And it is as follows. I swear before God and upon the Holy Gospels and promise, as becomes a bishop, to be loyal to the German Reich and the state. I swear and promise to respect the constitutional government and to have it respected by my clergy. And I think what you can see from that is that there have been serious problems with the clergy undermining the state, communist clergy, which is what was being purged. And that's why they had this new oath to say, look, they have to respect the state, and this was ordered by the Vatican.
It was backed by the Vatican. Yeah.
Yeah, this was ordered by the Vatican that the clergy had to swear allegiance to the Reich. So, of course, any that then went back on that, you know, quite rightfully, they would be sent off for re-education at the camps.
And this was the Holy Roman Empire again.
Well, you can see it's restoring the Holy Roman Empire right the way through this with all the all the different fascist states here, I think. Shortly after the Concordat was signed by Cardinal Pacelli and Catholic Franz von Papen, Cardinal Bertram of Berlin wrote to Hitler as follows. The episcopate of all the German dioceses, as is shown by its statements to the public, was glad to express, as soon as it was possible, after the recent change in the political situation, through the declarations of Your Excellency, its sincere readiness to cooperate to the best of its ability with the new government, which has proclaimed as its goal to promote Christian education, to wage war against godlessness and immorality, to strengthen the spirit of sacrifice for the common good, and to protect the rights of the church. And that's from the Catholic London Universe, August 18th, 1933. So that shows you that was what the National Socialist State had proclaimed. The new government had proclaimed that its goal was to promote Christian education, wage war against godlessness and immorality, and to strengthen the spirit of sacrifice for the common good and to protect the rights of the church. So that, you know, that's all Christian ideals. And this is what...
So how much of the change has been in that 5 years they were in Germany? Because we don't see any of this... not much of this on YouTube. I only stumbled on the author when he was talking about Hitler's Pope. I mean, the evidence of it is hard to find. It really is. But it obviously happened and it's been hidden.
Well, when they reformed the education system, you know, Christianity must have been at the centre of it.
Yeah.
Goal was to promote Christian education. Waging war against godlessness and immorality. I mean, that was atheistic communism. They're obviously, I mean, godlessness is atheism. So they were against atheism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
Sacrificing for the common good. I mean, that's Christian ideology, isn't it?
For sure, yeah.
In the way that it's supposed to be taught.
Yeah, this is the traditional Catholic church we're talking about. If there's ever going to be a fourth Reich, which is... Come and mark it, or European Union is going to may introduce at some point. It isn't the same church. That's a state and church reunion with Lucifer.
And protecting the rights of the church as well.
Yeah.
So what would that be? Church property? Because a lot of...
Well, I imagine so, yeah.
A lot of governments have and monarchs have just sort of stolen church property, haven't they?
If you look at
the Reformation. They just said, right, we're going to have this and we're going to have that. So I guess that's saying that's not going to happen. And also it must be the right of the church to teach the children. Because don't forget, we've heard in Italy, the clerics were given the right to teach the children. And in France, that was one of the big things that happened, was that the clergy were able to teach the children again. Because Hitler said about the instructing of the morals to the children has to come from the church.
No gender neutrality there.
No, none of that. And all for the common good.
Yeah.
Well, the next quote we've got is about Fritz Thyssen. Whatever the Catholic Church may now think about Hitler and the whole scheme of the National Socialist Fascist Axis, there is no doubt that the Vatican was Hitler's ally from the beginning. Fritz Thyssen, rich Catholic steel magnate who financed Hitler, testifies to this. After he went to Switzerland in 1940, Thyssen wrote an article in the Swiss Arbeitszeitung entitled Pius XII as Nuncio Brought Hitler to Power. In this article, he states plainly what the aim of the Hitler-Vatican plan was. He says the idea was to have a sort of Christian corporate state organized according to the classes, which would be supported by the churches, in the West by the Catholic, and in the East by the Protestant, and by the army. So none of this equality there. The church supports classes, which is a caste-based system, and the Christian corporate state, that's the Catholic corporatism, which grew into fascism in Italy. And obviously this was the same that the National Socialists were putting in place, was this idea of corporatism and the corporate state. And that's, you know, the big financier industrialist Fritz Thyssen.
Yeah.
He's the guy saying this. Do you know much about him, Dennis?
Well, no. I think he fell out with Hitler, which is why he moved to Switzerland. But I've yet to find out why. He had a big bust up.
I know he's often named as being one of the main capitalists with all the money that was funding Hitler.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there would have been a few, because nobody wanted the Bolsheviks next door to him.
Well, he's quite clear that it was the Pope that helped to bring Hitler to power. I mean, everybody says, oh, these rich capitalists, they were all funding Hitler. But when you look to the rich capitalist, he says, well, no, it wasn't. It was the Pope.
Yeah.
It was the Pope.
And that kills the Rothschilds-funded both sides myth, which I've always denied.
Well, you can also see why today they try to say that it was all these rich financiers that were doing it. Because it's quite clear here that it wasn't. It was the Pope is what he's actually saying. And that's covered up today, isn't it? That's hidden.
Oh, we're there, yeah. As is the... Well, I mean, there was... Believe it or not, the guy who wrote Hitler's Pope, there was another book in answer to that by a rabbi who praises Pope Pius to high heavens. Now, why? Because, you know, obviously, we know what happened. And... it must be this trying to keep this leak of out of Europe of what happened to Christianity. That's the only reason I can think of, because in the Hitler's Pope book, obviously, it goes into great detail to say he was anti-Semitic and you know, has a love for Germans. So again, another cover up.
Well, you do get some right wing conservative Jews that probably do, you know, support the Pope and say, well, the National Socialists fought against the communists.
Yeah, but it wasn't that way. What he was saying was Pius wasn't for National Socialism. You know, he did this and he did that, which proved it type of thing. The actual rabbi was kind of countering what was saying it was Pope.
Because we get all different types of Jews, and what the National Socialists were after was the communists and the ones that were against the Germans. I mean, there was quite
definitely, yeah,
You know, there were a lot of Jews weren't even put into the camps. There were reports of partial Jews that were fighting in the army. I remember reading a book a while back that was written by a Jew that lived in the Third Reich, and he ended up moving to America. And he was saying, you know, that there's been a lot of exaggeration and life was pretty good. And it was just the, you know, the subversives that were controlled. The people that were a danger to the nation, a danger to the state, the communists. Because don't forget, right. Germany had some experience of communism, didn't it? That short-lived Soviet Republic.
We know about that. Communism in Germany, that was a frightful read.
Yeah, I mean, they really did have a big problem with communism. And not just, you know, these communist parties, but terrorism with all these arms stashes that were hidden about the place, and, you know, plans for blowing up railway stations, and worse than the terrorism that we're getting today, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
A much bigger threat than, you know, the ISIS is in Britain, was the threat that Germany was facing from these communists. A lot more terrorism was actually going on, and they had full-on plans for an uprising that the Germans just managed to defuse in time. That's what that book is about, isn't it? It's showing you all the plans that they had for this proper uprising, where they were going to take over. And they had all these weapon stashes everywhere. They had the police working for them. They had bits of the army that were working for them. I mean, not just, you know, these individual suicide bombers, but there were sort of factions in amongst the police and in amongst the army that were on the side of the enemy, and they were all waiting for this day when they were going to have their big uprising. And the Germans managed to prevent that. Sure. None of that gets told. We just get, oh, they didn't like the Jews. They didn't like their religion. Oh, they thought they'd get their own back on them because the Jews killed Christ or something. I mean, they never really explain it properly, do they? It's just this crazy idea that Gentiles get.
Yeah, well, they didn't really wait for trials, did they? They just take them around the back and shoot them. Because, you know, they were what they were. They were there to cause chaos. And sometimes you have an explosion and plenty of people killed. And the person what did it would shoot off to the nearest communist country.
Well, there is an argument to be made, isn't there, that these people don't deserve it. I mean, when you look at... If you look at the way that the communists behaved, and then the communists hadn't signed up to the Geneva Convention, had they? So why should...
No, that's something the Soviet Union never did.
Yeah, so why should the Germans have treated them as if they had? As if they were on the same level as the Germans.
The sad thing is the Germans did stick to that with the Americans, for instance, and what America did to the troops over Germany.
Yeah, if you look at also the way that the Soviets treated the Germans that they got hold of, and there is an argument to be made. Well, why should we treat them in an honourable, chivalrous manner?
Well, you can't really. I mean, when they're cutting up German soldiers, cutting the testicles and insides while still alive, it's not really something you can have a treaty about, is it really?
Well, I think you can draw an analogy with it today Muslim terrorists and immigrants, and we treat them on an equal footing with ourselves, and they just abuse the legal system. Like this Shamima Begum, she's been told, well, that's it, you're going to be stripped of citizenship. And in that very letter that was given to her saying you're losing your British citizenship, they gave her all the papers to appeal. And obviously the appeal is going to be paid for by legal aid. And just why should she be given the same rights as a British man when she's gone out to join an enemy state? She's a traitor. She should be hanging. She shouldn't be told, well, you've got the same rights as British people, even though we've just stripped you of citizenship and you can appeal this ruling.
I agree. But the contradiction there is, of course, they've already let loads of fighters back into the country. So, you know, do they really intend to follow this through? I don't know.
Well, maybe.
Just for the show.
You know, with all these things, all this idea of international human rights and everybody's equal, for people that haven't actually fought for that, they're not entitled to it, and they will just abuse it. And it just ends up harming ourselves, giving them rights that they haven't actually fought for themselves. It happens throughout everything. I mean, we tell like blacks that they have the rights to everything that we have, and they never even invented a legal system. How can they have, how can they have rights?
Well, that's the problem. We've just got, they've got the rights and we've just got privileges which can be taken away.
Well, we have duties as well, don't we? They don't understand duties. This whole idea of rights, I think really the first thing you think of is duties. You don't think, oh, it's my right to take this. You think, you know, everything's been done for me. You think your parents provide you food, they provide you clothes. And the first thing you think of is, you know, well, how can I do something for them? Not, well, it must be my right to just take everything I want.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the way we're taught today, is that it's all about rights, but it should be about duties. You should think, well, how can I pay back my duty to my parents and my ancestors for everything that they've done for me? Because everything that we've got is provided by them. And you think, well, the way to pay them back is to create more descendants for my ancestors and provide for the descendants. You do the same thing that's been done for you. But our way of looking at it today is, oh, it's your right to take everything that you possibly can. It's your right to make as much profit as you can from those around you. When it should be, it's your duty to do as best you can for the people that come after you.
Well, that's the Christian way.
And the nationalist way.
Yeah.
You know, the two, I think, are inseparable, nationalism and Christianity. The morals and the ideology of Christianity is inseparable from nationalism. Well, I've got a final bit here. And that's the religious affiliations of the National Socialist and Fascist governments. And these following facts have been checked with official publications and bureaus of information. Adolf Hitler, Nazi Führer, Roman Catholic. Benito Mussolini, Italian Duce, Roman Catholic. Francisco Franco, Spanish Caudillo, Roman Catholic. Antonio Salazar, Portuguese dictator, Roman Catholic. Henry P. Pétain, Vichy Chief of State, Roman Catholic. Pierre Laval, Vichy Chief of Government, Roman Catholic. Joseph Tiso, Slovakian Chief of State, Roman Catholic priest. Vidkun Quisling, Premier of Occupied Norway, Protestant. Anton A. Mussert, Premier of Occupied Holland, Protestant. Emil Hascher, National Socialist President of Bohemia Moravia, Roman Catholic. Konrad Heinlein, Premier of Sudetenland, Roman Catholic. Leon de Grel, Belgian resistance leader, Roman Catholic. And Ante Pavlic, Croatian poglavar or leader, Roman Catholic. So overall, they're mainly Roman
Catholic. I think they're all pagan. I think they're all lying in the speeches for over 20 years. They're really pagans.
They're all Odinists. I think it's interesting that we've got two Protestants there. So that's showing you that nationalism transcends the, you know, the sectarianism between Catholicism and Protestant. It transcends it. Yeah. You've got Protestants working together with Catholics here. And right when Hitler took power, there was a big problem between the Protestants and the Catholics. They were divided. And nationalism is something where you can come together on this. I mean, even at Radio Aryan, we've got Catholics, we've got Orthodox, we've got Evangelicals, Christian identity. And we're all united by our nationalism. Yeah, if you look at the mainstream Christian sects, they all fight amongst each other. They all say that the other one can't be right. And look at the problems that we had in Northern Ireland between Protestants and Catholics. And yet here you've got them all working together to fight against communism.
I can guarantee the Freemason had a hard time in all them countries.
Definitely. Well, that was it. And they were against Freemasonry.
Yeah,
but it just proves it was a Christian movement, wasn't it?
Sorry, go on.
I just say it just proves it was a Christian movement led by Christians.
That's right. But after the war, they were all replaced again by Rothschild's men, which would have been the Freemasons.
Yeah, led by Christians, funded by the church, and destroyed by the Freemasons and the communists. All right, Dennis, thank you very much for coming on today. I think that's been a good
show.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you in the spring sunshine.
tuned into Radio Aryan.